a gun to a man that surrenders. What's it gonna take for someone to defend her? If we all agree that we're equal as people, then why can't we see what is evil? I can't breathe. You're taking my life from me. I can't breathe. Will anyone fight for me?
And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. Well, I'm really excited about the interviews that we're about to have on this evening's show. We'll be talking to two activists, each involved with a local organization that believes and acts with it in mind that a better world is possible and that our participation in creating that world is important. We're going to spend the first part of our show learning more about their organizations, which are Community Solidarity, a hunger relief program whose goal is to end hunger, poverty, and homelessness, and Suffolk County Democratic Socialists of America, or Suffolk DSA. And then stay tuned for further conversation as each of these change agents shares the story of when and why they saw fit to change their own lives by changing their diet, and how that relates to the work that each of them has taken on to create the worlds that they envision is possible. Now, today's show is different than most of those that we've done in the past, and that's because my co-host, who helped me produce this segment, is Jennifer Green. She's the founder of Vegan Long Island. Jennifer has added her unique flavor to this show and is personally involved with several organizations and a couple that are making it into this show, and you'll hear a lot more about in the next hour. So thanks, Jennifer, for your help in both visioning this show and pulling together the elements and the guests.
It's been my pleasure, Bob. Thank you. I really love facilitating connection among people, because when we connect with other people and work together, we get stuff done. So getting the word out about opportunities like these to connect with groups of people who are making a difference is something I am passionate about.
Yeah, and connection is key, as we always say. And this show will be about identifying some local challenges and connecting you, our listeners, with some of the ambitious efforts taking place to address those challenges. And that's important, since one thing that's certain is that if we don't identify the issues that matter, we're never going to be able to address them powerfully as a community without that connection. In addition, by hearing about those people and organizations that are already working on the issues that we're already passionate about, it enables any of us to become powerful agents for change without going out and starting our own organizations. But simply by pitching in our volunteer energy, whatever that happens to be, our unique talent, our resources, our connections, or whatever else that we might bring to the table. So without further delay, Jen, why don't you get us started with our first guest?
So our first guest is Payal Mehta, a 15-year resident of Long Island, recovering corporate employee, and she is an active volunteer with Community Solidarity for over 4 years.
Welcome, Payal.
Thank you so much.
So Community Solidarity, a Long Island organization, is America's largest vegetarian hunger relief organization and helps thousands of families each week by sharing free plant-based groceries, clothing, books, toys, school supplies, and vegan hot meals. And Payal, you've been very committed as a volunteer with this effort for years. To say that the scope of Community Solidarity's work is impressive, from my perspective, would be a major understatement. So Payal, I'm going to ask you to start off by giving our audience an idea about how Community Solidarity works.
A great question, and I will try my best to make it as simple as possible, because it really is very simple. It's just that there's a lot of work involved. And I think once I heard us described, there was an article in the Times where they described us as a pop-up food pantry, which I was like, that's a good way to start. We're not a food pantry. We're really unique in that we're giving fresh food and, you know, vegetables, fruits to the community. So I think that really sets us apart. But the way we're doing this is we are going to grocery stores like Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, you know, some farms that are local here. And we're taking things that they've said, we can't sell these, or we don't have room on our shelf, or whatever the reason might be. And normally they would have thrown it out. But instead, they've said, we're going to set this aside. And volunteers like myself, like so many other people with community solidarity, will come, we'll pick it up, and then we will have these organized, what we call food shares, and we'll give it away. And it's that simple. But if you think about the scope, as you mentioned, we have 5 food shares every week, different locations on Long Island, one in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. And so this work is happening literally every day. The pickups, the shares, you know, all that is happening every day by so many volunteers. And it's a lot of grocery stores that we're going to. So the way it works, honestly, is because of people like your listeners, people like myself, that are going out there, giving their time, using their own vehicles to pick up things. We do have a van, which I'll tell you about more later, but we do have one vehicle that we use to load up as much as we can, but certainly we can't have one person going to every single grocery store on Long Island. And we organize it during our shares, just like you would find things in a grocery store. So we keep fruits and vegetables together, pantry items, breads, flowers even, we get donated. And then we also get donations of books from other nonprofits or as well, like the Book Fairies. And we create, like post-pandemic, we've changed a little bit how we do it. Before, everyone could walk up and they could select the items they wanted, just like in a grocery store. But now what we do is we make a 40 to 50 pound box that is filled with, majority of it is filled with fruits and vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables.
That's enormous. And
yeah, it's heavy. It's heavy. So some of our community members that are seniors that are, you know, walking, it is actually a challenge for them. So, you know, they bring their bags and carts. They have to transfer things sometimes into their, you know, whatever it is that they're carrying. But post pandemic, we've made these boxes and we started up a drive-through line. So if you come to one of our shares, what you'll see when we get started is you'll already see a long line of cars. I mean, there are families that come. They don't need to, but they come really early, maybe 2-3 hours before our start time. And we start at the same time every day. And we have a set location, set place. So the community knows, like, this is the time, this is the place. They can count on us. That's why we're there every week. We're not just here and there. And they're there because they, you know, they desperately need this. It's going to help them save some dollars off their budget, you know, getting all this food. And when we get started, we are able to put the food directly into their trunk. It's so much safer for the community, especially this past year and a half, I guess, with everything that was going on with the pandemic. It helped keep our volunteers safe. It helped keep the community safer. So that's what you'll see. You'll see these line of cars. We do have, in some places, we do have people on foot that walk up as well. And our volunteers, you know, in the back, we have no back because we're all outdoors. We do all this in sometimes, honestly, on halfway in the road, halfway on the sidewalk, in our Hempstead location, we're in a train station parking lot, but we are outdoors, no matter what the weather. And you'll see our volunteers sorting, unloading all the different volunteers that are coming through with donations, creating those boxes. We create like an assembly line so we can fill them all up. And, you know, that goes on, I would say, probably at least 3 hours. In some locations, it might take a little longer for us to serve all the families that have come through and, you know, assemble all the food into these boxes. So that's in a large nutshell, what we're doing and how it works.
Wow. Well, so you've told us about what somebody who goes to the food share would experience and what would be provided. Can I ask, how did you get involved? What was your first, how did it get on your radar?
Yeah, so I was looking for a place to give my time where I wanted to be there, if that makes sense. Like, I know sometimes people volunteer for all different reasons, right? Like when you're younger, maybe it's because you need some extracurricular credit, you know, for volunteer hours for school. Maybe, you know, maybe if, you know, some of our some volunteers have come, you know, they need to do certain community service hours, you know, for whatever trouble they might have gotten into. But I wanted, you know, I didn't have that. That wasn't my situation. And when I was younger, when I was in high school, volunteering was such a big part of my life. I did it for school, for the diploma I was program I was in, but I liked it. I loved it. I actually would go out and try to find all the opportunities. And so as an adult and as a mom, and at that time my son was about 4 or 5 years old, I wanted to find a place where I believed in the organization. Whatever it was that their mission was resonated with me. I felt pulled by it, or I felt strongly about it. And up until that point, I really hadn't come across anything, because there are things that also I didn't feel comfortable with. Like, you know, maybe this is not a good thing to say, but I didn't feel comfortable going into maybe like a senior center and volunteering with seniors, or, you know, into a hospital, you know, with maybe sick patients that, you know, could use some cheering up. Like, it sounds lovely, but I was like, I don't feel comfortable. So there were so many criteria, like amorphous as it might sound, that I had. And I started Googling. I went on meetup.com, and there was a meetup. It's not there anymore, but it was something like, I guess Facebook would be the equivalent if anyone's looking for things, but it was something about Long Island volunteer opportunities. And I saw this food share. And I thought, okay, what's this? And I saw that it was vegetarian. And I've been vegetarian for 20 something years. So I thought, oh, I like this. I don't have to work in a soup kitchen where I might be handling meat. I really didn't want to do that. And I thought, you know, this could be something that my family, my husband, my son could come with me and experience. And we could do this as a family. And that's really how I started. As I, you know, I wrote in and I said, hi, I'd like to volunteer. And a very nice volunteer wrote me back and gave me the directions, and I showed up, and the rest is history. Like, I kept coming back.
Amazing. I've heard stated several times that this is an all volunteer organization. Again, my question is, how is that possible? Because, because I know the amount of organization it takes, number one, just to direct so many volunteers, and number two, to coordinate any kind of organized effort. Something that's happening on an every month basis is a big deal. Something that happens every week is all consuming. Again, do you have any words of wisdom to tell us about how this is possible?
Yeah, you know, I've been with the organization for about over 4 years now, but it's been around, I think it's going on its 16th year now. So I haven't been there from the beginning, but I can tell you that the founders of the organization, I think they started with, you know, the story I've heard is they started with a folding table and like 6 loaves of bread, and it's turned into this huge thing. So if you go to our website and you'll see all these photos and all these people, or if you've ever been to a share, you're just like, what? So
kind of like the miracle of the loaves, you know, a certain number of loaves of bread and fish turned into this whole vegetarian feeding effort to thousands.
Exactly. Minus the fish, right?
Minus the fish, but, yes.
Yeah. So today, you know, we have one employee who, you know, it's John Stepanian, who's one of our co-founders. But if you, again, if you look at some of these other nonprofits and food pantries, and, you know, you see how much their employees are getting paid compared to the meager salary that John is taking for himself. It is really miraculous. And the reason, I think, is because this is really a for the community, by the community effort. This is not our food to give to people. This is food is a right, is something you'll see on our website. I didn't really understand what that meant when I started volunteering. I was like, I don't get it. I mean, now I get it. You know, now I understand that it's like, oh, because this isn't our food. We don't own this. It shouldn't be that some people can afford healthy food and others can't. Everyone should be afforded healthy food. So the reason it works is because the community are the ones coming for food. They are volunteering to help. You know, they will do both. A lot of times, a lot of our volunteers, they will come get food for themselves and they will stay to help, or vice versa. And I think that's why it works. It is set up fairly so that everyone's treated as equitably as we can, right? Like, you know, of course we wanna accommodate people like seniors, for example. We try to serve them first. You know, we do what we can there. And, you know, we do offer like things like gluten-free boxes or all vegan boxes, for example, when needed, or even a diabetic box. Or I think we have one person who comes and she can only eat soft foods. So like, you know, a volunteer will go and do that for her because we know that that's what she can eat. So I think that's why you have volunteers that just come back. And when they come, they are there. And it's just, you know, I think the volunteers that I see that come back week after week, they come because you can directly see the impact of your effort. You can see how much work there is to do, and you can't sit by and just not do it. In fact, a lot of us volunteers have a lot of guilt when we can't come to a share, or, you know, even Sunday, I had to leave a little early and I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm leaving early. And I think that's why it works. In the 4+ years, you know, I've been volunteering, there's definitely been times where we're worried because maybe our volunteer count wasn't as high, or we're missing a vehicle for a pickup. I don't think there's ever, I mean, knock on wood, I don't want to jinx us, but I don't think there's ever been a time where we haven't been able to get it done. You know, because everyone who comes is there because they want to be there, not because they're forced to, not because they were bused there. We don't recruit volunteers. You know, we invite people to come, but we never recruit. I guess it might be simplifying it, but I think that's why it works.
Thanks, Pyle. So you described the quantity of food that people are getting when they come to the food shares. And you mentioned John Stepanian. And I remember hearing a talk that he gave some years ago about where this food is coming from, right? Can you say more about that, about where is the food coming from that you're getting and what that represents?
As far as like why and what gets getting donated, I'm thinking that's where you're going with that question.
Well, I just meant the fact that if it weren't being rescued, what would happen to it, right? This is an incredible waste issue.
It is, and it would get trashed. I mean, bottom line, I don't think that it costs a grocery store or a restaurant. It doesn't do, it's not, there's no difference for them if they trash it or if they donate it. Mm-hmm. It's probably less work if they just haul it over to the dumpster and trash it, as opposed to setting it aside for us. So the scary thing for me, which I try not to think about too much, is, you know, we're doing so much. Any time you come to the share, you will see like mountains of food. And that's only a fraction of the grocery stores on Long Island. And that's just one small geographic area as well. So the amount of food waste that is happening, I think, you know, most of us know that this is a real problem, is just, I just don't have words. But that's what would happen.
That's mind-blowing. Yeah, and the reality that represents, which is that there is enough food, right?
Yes.
There's no need for hunger.
There's enough food at a time when there is ample hunger.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is just part of one of like the hardest things to just grapple with, honestly, because, you know, when you come and volunteer, you are seeing the faces of the families that are coming through to get this food. I mean, I see children, you know, very young children coming with their parents in the heat, in the cold, waiting a long time. And I just think to myself, you know, there's no reason for this. There's just plenty to go around. And it makes me a little mad. Like, why is this still happening?
Certain anger is called for. Food is being thrown away. People aren't eating. That's a problem. So when you said that a long line of cars, I saw a video with John Stepanian in it. And he said that the cars for the food share could be lined up for miles. He said, especially during COVID, when it was getting pretty dire.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I think that's likely true. I mean, I'm so focused when I'm there on just, okay, what do I need to do next? What do I need to do next? John is really focused on really everything. And so he's also monitoring the number of cars. He's trying to manage, you know, with other volunteers as well, like trying to help manage the queue, because we can't have cars going out in the street. You know, you could have accidents, right? So we're trying to manage them, and every share is a different location. So, you know, there's special challenges at each one. But there's a really, really long line of cars. And once we get started, I feel like we get through this line fairly quickly, but you know, in the meantime, right, like people are showing up and showing up. And yeah, I think in Hempstead, there's a photo John took, because what we started doing is we started kind of lining up the cars in rows inside the parking lot, so they're out of the street. And I think there was a day where I was standing at the front of that line, and I'm looking out at five lines of cars, you know, all lined up, all facing me, waiting for their turn to go through, plus the other line that's snaking around to go to the front where they're getting loaded up with food. And it's overwhelming every time.
Wow. Well, I don't know if there's anything else that you would describe as a challenge running this enormous food sharing effort, but are there any other factors that come to mind as the biggest challenges that community solidarity faces?
I think besides just the logistical thing, honestly, I feel like that's the easy part because we always have volunteers, you know, and everyone who's there works so hard to make everything run and get the community through quickly so they're not waiting so long. You know, that some of the things that have surprised me is sometimes pushback, you know, pushback from sometimes local businesses, you know, if we're too close to where their place of business is, where they're operating, sometimes towns, you know, town politicians, you know, people in office, that instead of seeing like what we're doing to try to alleviate or try to help people in their community, kind of see us as a nuisance, or, you know, they think that we're creating the problems, and it's like, no, we're not creating homelessness. It's here. And we that's not going to go away, you know, if we're here or if we're not here. And actually we could be helping people. And there have been many people that have come and used our services and then have gone on to have their own business and come back and paid it forward. So I would say that's, you know, one of the things that kind of surprised me about just kind of the misunderstanding of what it is that we're doing and who it is that we're helping. You know, there are people just like you and I.
Kudos to you and to Community Solidarity for taking this on. And to wrap up this segment, tell people who are listening how they can find out more about Community Solidarity, how they can chip in to help, how they can contribute, volunteer, et cetera, whatever you can say.
You got it. So communitysolidarity.org is our website, has all the information for all the shares, for volunteers as well, or if you need assistance, you can see all that information. One thing I want to mention is that if you do come and to get food, there's no questions asked. We're not going to ask you your name, nothing. You come by, we'll say hi, and we'll say bye. And, you know, and if you want to chat, that's great. But we don't ask you for any personal information. And if you want to come help, that information is there as well. We welcome volunteers. We welcome people to come and see it for themselves, as long as you can stay. There's no like, I have to be here at this time and leave at this time. The times, approximate times, are listed there, but whatever you can do to help in person is great. And if you can't help in person, funds are definitely important. We do not get any funding from the government. We don't have a millionaire backing us or any kind of corporations backing us. We don't have sponsors. So, you know, we truly run from donations from the community. So if you can contribute to us, that's fantastic. But otherwise, communitysolidarity.org, check us out on Facebook. You can learn a lot more that way as well.
Fantastic. Thank you, Pyle. This is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM. We just spoke to Pyle Mehta, a volunteer with Community Solidarity.
Bob, our next guest is Tim Karsich. Tim is an educator and the co-chair of the Suffolk County Democratic Socialists of America, or Suffolk DSA for short. Now, on the front page of Democratic Socialists of America's website, in big type, it asks, why should I become a socialist? And the stated answer on the webpage is, you don't become a socialist. You discover you've been one all along. So, Tim, can you explain democratic socialism to our listeners, many of whom I'm sure don't have a good idea of what that is, and also describe why you think that most people would discover that they've been a democratic socialist all along?
Sure, and thank you for having me on the show today, guys. You know, the way that I think you become a democratic socialist, that like it says on the website, is you discover you've been one all along. When I was a kid, my mom told me to stand up against bullies taking lunch money in the cafeteria. And, you know, now I'm 32 and I've grown to see that there are a lot more bullies taking a lot more than lunch money than there were when I was a kid. Whether it's the landlord or an investment bank or your boss or whoever, they're trying to steal our humanity away from us. You know, and like organizations like DSA and what socialism really is just putting power back into the hands of working people in, you know, any number of ways. I mean, socialism touches like a lot of facets of society, but that might mean like publicly funded elections so we can get special interest money out of elections. You know, on Long Island, imagine if police money was out of elections. I mean, that's a really hot topic. But publicly funded elections, like public banking, if there was banking in the public interest and not Wall Street investment banks saying we're going to build some condos instead of, you know, affordable housing. That's what democratic socialism would look like. A union in every workplace. You know, we define socialism as worker power. So it's working people being in control of the decisions that affect their everyday lives.
Tim, when many people hear of democratic socialism, all they hear is socialism. And that word is being used really to strike fear in the hearts of many Americans, even though that's beginning to change. Democracy, government by the people, on the other hand, is something that inspires patriotic feeling, pictures of the American flag, and is looked at as synonymous with the United States form of government. However, some see today's democracy as having morphed into an oligarchy, where most people don't have much of a say in our government and where a small group of very wealthy people and corporations have a disproportionate say. With that said, I'm going to ask you, do you think that democratic socialism is more democratic than our current system of capitalism in the United States?
I absolutely do. I mean, like I said before, socialism is worker power, you know, letting people make the decisions that affect their lives. Imagine a job interview. You know, you go into a job interview and the hiring committee or the boss is going to ask you, why should we hire you? And yeah, that's a fair question, but the interviewee never gets to ask, well, why are you hiring? You know what I mean? Like, you don't know, there is so much that like regular people don't know about the invisible forces that are affecting our lives. That's what democratic socialism really is. That's what socialism is. It's like demystifying the things that affect our lives. Like, people are afraid of it because there's a number of reasons. There's not just one reason why people are afraid of the word. I think some of it is definitely like a hangover from the Cold War. So like Western propaganda systems, you know, painting socialism as like famines in Russia or China. But, you know, last month Americans were filling up plastic bags with gasoline. So like, it is absolutely more democratic to be a socialist because that means that you, like community solidarity does, people need access to food, you know, to live. People need access to housing. If you're focused on, you know, working free jobs and paying rent and you can barely afford basic necessities, like you're not going to be able to, voting isn't a federal holiday here. Maybe you don't have time to do the basic democratic thing in America, voting. People need basic needs met, and that's what DSA is about. That's what socialism is about. And it makes, you know, democratic participation more likely. It makes for a more invigorating social movement in America.
So under democratic socialism, people would still go out and vote and they would be represented. Would they be more fairly represented than they are today? Because I know, for instance, us in New York, we're not really fully represented the way other people in other states are because of the numbers of people in the state and because the number of representatives that cover the number of people. And we have a lot of people in New York State with the Electoral College, with the number of senators we get. You know, it's just not really a representative form of government for the people in New York State. So would that change under socialism, democratic socialism?
I think so. And I think like that's one of the biggest problems in the country, like at large. I forget what the name of the law is, but in the 1900s, early 1900s, they changed the law, or they made it so representatives could only govern. They changed the cap for how many people they could govern in their districts, which like affects gerrymandering and stuff like that, making it really hard for communities of color to even vote. and the, when the country started and a lot of the early history, like people were governing maybe 200,000 people tops, like in Congress. Now you could be representing like high hundreds of thousands of people, you know, and going back to like publicly funded elections, like I mentioned earlier, one of the reasons it's really hard to run for office is like the special interest money in this country. And like, if elections were publicly funded, one of the biggest hurdles is raising funds. And if everyone has an equal amount of money to go around, it's much easier to run and it's easier to challenge incumbents who have been in office for decades, who are, you know, maybe in bed with, it's a totally corrupt system here in Suffolk County. So, I mean, we can elaborate on Suffolk corruption. There's a decades, maybe even centuries long history of that. Socialism, democratic socialism would, I think, eradicate that to a significant degree.
I have a sort of follow-up question, if I can, Bob. So we're talking about elections, but I want to get clear that DSA, the National Democratic Socialists of America, is not a political party right now, right? It's a political organization, but I have been hearing in the news of DSA members winning office. For example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, of New York's 14th congressional district. She's in the Democratic Party, and she's also a member of DSA. So at the state or local level, can you tell us about DSA members who are winning office?
Sure. I mean, we had the Democratic primary day just last week, and a bunch of DSA candidates, DSA-backed candidates, won office. You know, probably the biggest one is India Walton, won the Democratic primary for the mayor of Buffalo. One of her big things is a police community review board with teeth, because a lot of community review boards don't really actually have power over police. That's one of her big policies. But all across the state, there were a couple of New York City council members that DSA won, that backed, that won already. But because of the ranked choice voting, some of the other candidates still have to count for absentee ballots and stuff like that. Buffalo, New York City Council, but Ithaca, Albany, Rochester, a lot of these cities in upstate New York have recently had candidates that won office, mostly local stuff like city councils there. But here in Riverhead too, we had a DSA member, Colin Palmer, who won a school board race in Riverhead. And I mean, I can elaborate on that too, but like after the George Floyd protests, a lot of Suffolk Police Benevolent Association backed candidates were up for school board. School boards are traditionally not, you know, politicized campaigns. It's an unpaid position, and you know, you don't really have a ton of power over curriculum. It's like just making sure that the school functions in like a, you know, democratic way, making sure that money is spent the way that it should be spent. And the PBA really, I guess in the wake of the protests, because protests were rampant here over the summer last year in a way that I'd never seen. You know, the PBA backed these candidates to run for school board. They mostly lost, but in Smithtown, all three candidates won. Smithtown is, you know, for listeners who may not be familiar, in case you're not, is an extremely white area of Suffolk County, like 82% white or something like that. We had Colin Wynn, who ran on, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion in Riverhead, because they're about to close the Latin program. And he's been a student of Riverhead schools, and he loved their Latin program there. And, you know, God forbid we, you know, read books, you know, written by Black people in this country and talk about, like, in history class, the GI Bill, you know, while it helped create the suburbs, you know, for white families here, the GI Bill didn't exactly help Black families. Like, I think in New York and New Jersey, of the first 66,000, you know, GI Bills that went out to veterans, like, less than 100 of those helped Black families get mortgages. And, you know, the racially segregated suburbs are why we have 124 segregated school districts here. Hmm. So yeah, I mean, DSA has been winning. That they won a bunch of primaries last week. And yeah, we have Colin winning in Riverhead, which was very exciting last month.
Yeah.
So it is possible.
That's great. So Tim, let's assume that the country is all of a sudden behind a comprehensive switch in systems from our current capitalism to a democratic socialist system. What would our country look like, and how would it impact those at various levels of income?
It would empower people who make less money typically than people who make a ton of money. That's the really short answer. Beyond, like, you know, real policy wonk stuff, like I've mentioned already, like publicly funded elections, which are like basic democratic, you know, kind of principles. What if childcare was free in this country? What, like, I see Pyle like reacting on the Zoom call here, but like that's a huge function for like just parents existing. And like, I mean, forget politics, like you should be able to have fun. Like if you're alive, like you should have, I mean, in the old days, like the labor movement slogan was 8 hours for work, sleep, and play. You know, you have a right to exist in this country. And if childcare was subsidized rather than, you know, paying for tanks and airplanes and giving, you know, money to corrupt governments all over the place for reasons of imperialism and war, like maybe if our basic needs were met, people's lives would be easier. You know, when you were asking the question, the main word that comes to mind, I think, for me is active. Like people would be more active. And I mean that in, I guess, multiple ways. Like you would have time to do things. You know, you would be active in your local community organizations. You know, maybe you would start a community garden. Maybe you would write a book. You would do something socially useful. And maybe the other big difference is like things that are not socially useful in this country, like profiting off of housing crises, any number of, you know, capitalist crimes, like maybe those would decrease and people's like life fulfillment, I think, would increase.
Yeah. And I just want to say that on the issue of health and healthcare, before I moved to Long Island, I lived for a brief time in a country where they had guaranteed universal healthcare. And that's something that I think about just as we were talking, food is a right, you know, healthcare should also be provided. Maybe that's a good segue to the next question from Bob.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about some of the topics that democratic socialists address. And I'll give you a topic and you give us the DSA position and what actions are being pursued and any other thoughts that you have on it. The Green New Deal.
Yeah, the Green New Deal is our plan to address the climate crisis because the world is on fire, you know, forest fires burning. If you remember last year, that's when the Green New Deal got a lot of steam with like the Amazon burning for months on end, et cetera, et cetera. But the basic principle is you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. Like 11.5% of Earth's species are facing extinction. This is because corporations put profit over people. You know, and the Green New Deal wants to make sure that everybody has access to free and clean energy to the extent that it's possible. We'd like to nationalize fossil fuels so we can phase them out in a way that's as quick and natural as possible. Maybe a publicly owned power grid would be a good idea, you know, democratically owned power. We've seen that. There's been a public campaign that DSA has been involved in. Both New York City and Suffolk and Nassau DSA have been a big part of the campaign to fully municipalize LIPA because the public-private partnership with PSE&G does not work. You know, Tropical Storm Isaias, maybe a million people, a couple hundred thousand were left without power for weeks on end. I mean, that's because PSE&G lied, a private company lied about the technology that they had, saying that they were equipped for the storm and they weren't, you know? And like later on, months later, they charged people's PSE&G bills were like hundreds of dollars. And that's, what are you paying for? You're paying for 18 people's salary who are at LIPA who are unaccountable to us. And, you know, maybe LIPA could be democratically run and there could be elections for LIPA like there are elections for public office, not just appointed bureaucrats who pretend to run the power grid when they just make money. What if, you know, I mean, this is related to, fossil fuels, but what if instead of everyone driving cars, you know, I know that's hard to believe when like the land of Robert Moses and the land of never ending highways here, but like, what if the Suffolk Transit bus system was, what if it actually had buses that ran on time? You know, what if it was free? What if it was cheap or free? You know, there'd be less carbon emissions. You wouldn't be complaining about $3 for a tank of gasoline. I mean, that's what the Green New Deal is locally and nationally.
Let's move on to something that you mentioned, which is the Suffolk County Police Department and the corruption. Now, in preparing for this interview, I was reading something about that. And, you know, as much as I think I know about a lot of issues, some things I just haven't heard, especially about local politics. I don't know a lot about them. And reading about this was a bit shocking. So talk about that and how DSA is involved.
Yeah, this is an extremely, I can talk about this for hours. I'll try to be as brief as I can. One of the shorter ways to explain it is the Police Benevolent Association, which is the major police union in the country, and the Suffolk PBA for short is the Suffolk Police Benevolent Association. They own Suffolk County. So ostensibly they, Newsday has reported on this and the New York Times has as well. They illegally collect donations from their union members, so cops, who are among the highest paid cops in the country. They take a dollar a day from their officers, and this is every PBA. There's tons of PBAs across the island. Suffolk PBA is the big one. They have a super political action committee that where they funnel the money to. The big one is the Long Island Law Enforcement Foundation. That money poisons everything in this county. It buys off every politician. There are only two Suffolk legislators that do not take PBA money. That money goes all over the county and it poisons the political culture and it prevents police accountability. So like there were 8 listening sessions late last year to hear from community members about police reform in wake of the George Floyd protests. This was a Governor Cuomo initiative. He wanted to have a reform plan from every municipality in the county and the state. Suffolk County put forth, you know, the listening sessions were good. There were a lot of people voicing good concerns, but because Steve Ballone, our county executive, is bought off by the Suffolk Police Union. I mean, again, the Suffolk corruption goes into the Long Island serial killer case, the police chief James Burke beating people up, and the former DA, Tom Spoda, covering this up. Cop money buys off everyone in the county, and it's really hard when there's such a strong cop culture here to hold police accountable in any way. Cops are never indicted in cases of police violence. Derek Chauvin is a exception to that rule, but you know, justice would be George Floyd living. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily Derek Chauvin going to prison. But Suffolk DSA has been calling for getting cop money out of politics. I've been saying publicly funded elections a lot, but I think that's a major, major way police affect politics and culture in Suffolk County.
We're running short on time, but I will ask you about the recent school board controversies over masks and critical race theory.
Yeah, critical race theory is a non-issue. Frankly, it's not taught outside of major universities. It's a non-issue that conservative think tanks created, like the Heritage Foundation in Washington. They've astroturfed a campaign to the point where groups like Moms for Liberty are going to school board meetings talking about how critical race theory is in schools, in basically a fight to preserve white supremacy and distract us from the Capitol siege that happened in January. Because a lot of these politicians are trying to like hide and get away from that. But you know, I mean, like I said, after the protest, the Suffolk PBA backed these candidates, most of them lost. And in this effort to keep, you know, pro-cop curriculum and like pro-white, you know, don't talk about slavery, don't talk about the GI Bill kind of curriculum going, they're using critical race theory as kind of a boogeyman. And, you know, all we're really talking about is teaching anti-racism in schools. Like, again, teaching about the GI Bill. Anti-racism in schools is the difference maker between showing the photo of Emmett Till's face after he was, you know, shot, lynched, and drowned in the Tallahatchie River in Mississippi and not showing it in schools. You know, like a lot of these Moms for Liberty groups do not want to talk about that. And, you know, it's because they don't want to be made uncomfortable. And if you're uncomfortable with anti-racism in schools, I think you should ask yourself why you're uncomfortable.
And raising these boogeymen is related to campaign finances, because if they can raise money on something that scares people, makes people feel up in arms, they're going to elevate it regardless of how big an issue it is to start with.
Yeah, and exactly. And for masks too, the thing about masks is I think people are still afraid because, you know what, 600,000 people died from a preventable virus and healthcare isn't guaranteed in this country, and you know, you're scared and you want to be able to, you know, quote unquote, live freely. But with people blowing up at school board meetings with a week left of school, I think it's just a way to keep people active so they can fight for white supremacy later.
And because I want to stick it in just 1 minute on housing.
Yeah, our housing justice group is reaching out to renters who are fearing eviction. The eviction moratorium ends, I believe, in a month. We're reaching out with info about organizing rights and how to apply for renting assistance in New York State. And we're organizing for eventual eviction protections, which we assume are going to be needed in the months to come, unfortunately.
Great, thank you.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us today. Can you let the listeners know how they can find out more about Suffolk DSA?
Sure. The website you guys promoted is suffolkdsa.org. That's our main website, but you can also find us on social media at on Facebook, we're just Suffolk County DSA. And then on Twitter and Instagram, we're just at Suffolk DSA.
Thanks a lot. And here's a final question for both of you, and we'll take your answers one by one. Both of you have chosen to adopt a vegan diet or lifestyle, and I don't see that as a coincidence given your other work. So I'm going to ask you, what events in your life led to your choosing to adopt that different diet lifestyle that we've talked about extensively over the course of 15 years on this show? And how do you see that choice being connected to the work that you do with your organizations? Tim, why don't you start off?
Sure. It's funny because the show airs, I'm told, right after Democracy Now. Well, right. I looked up the date, actually. On April 7th, 2015, I was listening to Democracy Now, and I was feeling pretty good because the first segment was talking about how Barack Obama sold more weapons in 6 years than George W. Bush sold in 8. That was the first segment on the show. And then the second one, I was feeling really good. Like, I knew that, like, DSA, you know, it's not the Democratic Party, right? The second segment really blew my hair back in a good way, but in a way that I was totally unprepared for. The documentary Cowspiracy, I think, had been out for about a year. The filmmakers were on being interviewed, Kip Anderson and Keegan Kuhn. And Cowspiracy is a documentary about the environmental impact of eating meat. And I had never heard about that before. I did not, I mean, the stuff that rings out of my mind now is like 1,000 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of milk. You know, that's the one that sticks out. And I had no clue about what I was contributing to every day by, you know, eating a hot dog or whatever. I was shocked by the interview. I ordered the DVD right away. And in the movie, they cut like the neck off of a duck, I believe. And I just started, it's a line in the movie, but I said the line to myself before Kip says it in the film. How could I ask someone to do something if I wouldn't do something myself? You know, hurting an animal would be horrifying to me. But I was eating the end product of that process, you know, every day. And I had never really cared about animal rights before. The environmental impact caught my attention. And then a month later, I was in a bar on Mother's Day with my family, and I ordered a chicken salad without the chicken and without the blue cheese. And I have been vegan ever since. And it has been one of the best decisions I've ever made. I never feel bad physically anymore. And I don't see it as a diet. I see it as like a lens with which we view oppression. And I just, you know, so socialism, that obviously fits with like DSA, but it also includes, you know, animals. And one of the best decisions I've ever made, and I don't regret it at all. And I will always speak out for the vegan lifestyle. And yeah, so.
Great. Paya, why don't you add on to that?
So for me, so my background, my heritage, my family is from India, and we are Jain. And so my family, my extended family, historically, culturally, we were a vegetarian family, but for whatever reason, my dad, you know, was a bad boy and he ate meat. And so when he married my mom, she started eating meat. And then when they had kids, the kids started eating meat. And then when I was 10 years old, my dad, we had all gone on a trip to India, and my dad came back and was like, we are no longer going to eat meat. And being 10 years old, growing up in a small town in Florida, where, forget about being vegan, no one understood what vegetarian was. There were probably 5 Indian families in the entire town. I thought, okay, you know, my dad says we're gonna not eat meat, sure. However, I had really enjoyed the taste of Burger King and McDonald's and pepperoni pizza. That's what everyone served, you know, at any party you go to. And I was really conflicted for probably about 10 years between wanting to do what my parents wanted me to do and then wanting food to taste good. And finally, when I was in college, I caught myself doing something so ridiculous where I think I was going to get a fast food chicken sandwich. I would eat it in the car, throw the wrapper out, and then continue on to my final destination where I'd have a meal with friends. My friends, I mean, why would they care if I was vegan or not? And the amount of guilt that I was putting on myself over food was just ridiculous. And no one should feel guilty about what they eat. And so I made a decision one day and I said, you know what? Either pile, you eat meat and you just be, you know, out and loud and proud about it and just don't be ashamed of it, or you decide that this is not what you believe in. Like, you decide that you don't like this and don't eat it. and I quit. That day, I don't even remember exactly the day. I just made that decision to be vegetarian. And the way I became vegan is, I think I was questioning a lot about my religious background. You know, I didn't really get a real education in Jainism. I sort of had to fend for myself to figure out things. You know, there are things that people told me to do, but I didn't really know why. And, you know, the more I learned about it, it's really about, you know, kind of a live and let live philosophy. And I went to a conference, actually, there's a Jaina conference where I listened to a man, regular guy, engineer, you know, maybe in his 50s. And he talked about his experience visiting a dairy farm because he wanted to know where milk came from. And the thing that stuck out to me, the thing that it burned in my mind that I cannot unremember is he, first of all, I had no idea how dairy farms worked, how cows were raised, you know, how they're basically just being raped, you know, and to stay pregnant, right, to provide the milk because they're mothers. But the thing that's really stuck in my head was he saw blood from the cow's udder as it was going into whatever. And he asks the farmer, oh no, there's blood that got into that. You must have to throw all that out. And the farmer's like, no, there's an acceptable amount of blood and pus that can go into milk. and that shocked him. And I think he must've gone vegan after that. But that stayed with me for a long time. And I think it was a real struggle for me to, I think probably took me another 10 years to really fully get dairy products completely out of my life. And not only that, but even before then, I was avoiding things like silk because I learned that silk is from silkworms and wool and leather. I didn't really understand why everyone around me who was preaching vegetarianism really would admire and value actually greater leather goods and wool things. And I'm like, but you don't eat meat, but why do you think that's okay? So it just, you know, really made me question, well, what are all these people actually saying? And then I had to really listen to myself and really think about what do I believe in? So for me, it was really about compassion, living in harmony with the world around me and within myself. And it doesn't feel right, knowing what I know, to keep doing and supporting that. And, you know, I will leave you with this, is that I don't expect anyone to be a perfect vegan, but I think that it's great to try, you know, even if it's only one day, whatever you can do, however you can do it, just do it. And don't think that it's not enough, because it is something. So, you know, that's kind of what I had to tell myself.
You're here.
to get there. Yeah.
And, you know, what I always say is you don't become a vegan. You discover you've been one all along.
Because our just like democratic socialist.
How about that? Huh? Yeah, because our values are all in alignment. None of us believes in world hunger and adding to it. None of us believes in being cruel to billions of trillions of animals per year. Nobody believes in wasting our resources and destroying the rainforests and causing climate change and biodiversity loss. So none of us do. And yet making that choice is just aligning our actions with what we already believe in. So all of you who are listening, if you haven't figured it out yet, you will. And I think the world is actually figuring it out collectively. So on that note, we're going to end. This is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM. We've been speaking to Tim Karsich, an educator and co-chair of the Suffolk County Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, and Payal Mehta, a volunteer with Community Solidarity. Thanks so much for being with us this evening. And Jennifer Green, thank you for co-hosting this show and for helping produce it. I really appreciate all that you're doing in the community and all you've done to help with this program.
Right back at you, Bob. It was really a pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Well, there you have it. A different show than we normally do, and certainly hitting upon topics that we don't normally cover. When Jennifer told me that she was involved with DSA a couple of weeks ago, I said, what's DSA? So I'm just learning about all this, and I thought that with the Green New Deal and the enormous, enormous burden and responsibility that's being placed on our society right now in terms of climate change, to take action now or lose our opportunity to take action that's going to make a meaningful change possible. I thought that we needed to acknowledge that there are people in the political sphere that are directly addressing this as a central part of their platform. DSA is not a political party, but there are political parties, the Humane Party, the Green Party, and yes, to some degree, the Democratic Party, who are actually putting the environment front and center. And all the while we're all starting to get that this is so serious that it really dwarfs most other economic, environmental, and social issues that we're going to be faced with in years to come, there are still political parties out there who are pushing the big lie. And the big lie is that climate doesn't matter, that those 115 plus degree days in Portland, Oregon, or in Canada, or in the coldest parts of Siberia, don't make any difference. Like they're not even happening. That's not okay. It's been predicted for decades, and now it's happening. We're living it. And so now it's time to address it with no excuses. So in doing shows like this, I think it's great to bring in various aspects of the message that we've been putting forth for many, many years with Healthy Planet. One of those aspects, one of those issues, is world hunger. We've discussed it many, many times on a global scale in terms of how agriculture feeds it, no pun intended, how agriculture, the way it is designed today, is starving people. And we've never covered the local scale in terms of what happens on a local scale. Are the people eating? Are there efforts to feed those who aren't eating? And then, of course, the DSA discussion was another attempt at talking about why people are not eating. Why are we not addressing the environment? You know, there's a reason for us not prioritizing feeding people, not prioritizing having people receive health care. This is not a recommendation or a promotion of or any brand of politics, but it's saying that these issues need to be discussed and brought front and center. And if they're not, the people who pretend to be leaders, who are vying for our vote to be leaders, absolutely do not deserve it. You know, that's just level number one. It's like saying, okay, have you had a first grade education? No. Well, I'm sorry, you can't go into the sixth grade. If you do not know about the most pressing issues facing our society, you can't be elected a leader, period. And there you have it. We're out of time. This is Bob DiBenedetto on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We'll be back next week at the same time on July 9th at 6 p.m. For more information on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation, or perhaps soon in-person presentation, to your school or group, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org. That's healthyplanetusa.org, or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. And we are a member-supported organization as well. Also, like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right, even if the political climate is challenging. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four-legged friends, and enjoy this beautiful world that we all share. Good night.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience. But every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.